Good evening, Erev Tov. We're looking at chapter 28, Perek Kof Ches. This comes with a health warning, this chapter, by the way. So just to give you a heads up on this, because it is, without doubt, the strangest story in the Bible. And there's some pretty strange stories in Tanakh, but this one really goes above and beyond. And it's difficult to understand. The Meforshim are very perplexed. What is going on here? Are we meant to take this seriously? Is this a real event? Is it an event which, is in the imagination of people? I mean, what's going on? So we'll see. The topic we're dealing with is the topic of what is called in English necromancy. It's a word that only people who study Bible really know. If you go to your neighbor at work and say, you know what a necromancer is, they won't know what you're talking about. It's a bit like the word baron. It's only people who study Torah actually know this word baron, because otherwise people don't use these words. These are biblical words. So necromancy is one of these very strange, odd laws in the Torah, which basically we read last week, read in Parsha Kedoshim. That you should have nothing to do with Ovi, Adoni, all these people who seem to conjure up the spirits, what nowadays we call mediums. I always tell the students when I teach this that as much as you might be tempted to take a little dive into one of the tarot card readers on whatever it is, 34th Street or wherever they are in the center of town, basically don't. It's just not the way to go. And the warning comes from Shaul HaMelech. There's nobody sort of really greater than that who can give us this warning. But there's a terrible irony, as you'll see, in this whole story. And really, it's a very sad story with a lot of ramifications. So what we'll do is we'll look at the parsha, and then I've got a piece here which I want to go through very briefly from a sefer called Nishmas Chaim. Nishmas Chaim, as I mentioned last week, is a sefer written by somebody called Menashe ben Israel. Menashe ben Israel was a very great scholar who lived in Amsterdam in the 1600s, and is well known really in Hebrew schools in England, but not really anywhere else. The reason for that, as I said, is because he was responsible for the Jews returning to England. In 1656, what happened was that Oliver Cromwell made a deal with Menashe ben Israel. I think it was obviously a monetary deal, because in Amsterdam that was the center of the diamond business. So I think as a move to try and get some diamond dealers to move to London, they allowed the Jews back in. They were thrown out in 1290, and for nearly 400 years Jews were not in England. Which of course means that when Shakespeare wrote Shylock and The Merchant of Venice, Shakespeare probably had never seen a Jew. Had probably never ever, I mean he might have read about Jews, but he never ever seen Jews. Which does lend its own discussion, but not for now. Alright, so that's Menashe ben Israel, and we'll see what he has to say. A very interesting sefer. His whole sefer is about the neshama. He writes a lot of things about the soul. Really kind of spooky book, because he says a lot of things that really we're not sort of so comfortable listening to, but you'll see in a minute. Firstly, we'll go through the psukim very quickly. Chapter 28, page 129. Vayihi bayomim ahem, vayikbutzu pelishtim et machaneim latzava. So now we know there's another war in the pipeline with the Plishtim, as always, in this particular time period. Lilachem b'Yisrael, they're fighting Israel. David, this goes back on what we said last week. David has fled with some of his men to the other side. He's gone to the Plishtim. And he's claimed allegiance to Achish, when in fact, of course, this is all a ruse, and he doesn't really mean it. And he's using it as an excuse to try and help Am Yisrael as best he can. It's a bit like Shimshon in his day, when Shimshon claimed that he was one of them, but he really was one of us. And it's very interesting. That's the whole thing that will come back again in chapter 29, which we'll talk about possibly today, but certainly next week when we do the run-up to the end. So that's the story here. So basically, Achish is saying to David, you should be loyal to me. Possibly, basically, Yom David al Achish, lechein ata teida. You'll know what your servant will do. In other words, me. Basically, Achish says, if you're so loyal, I'm going to make you my bodyguard, which is about as loyal as it gets. So this is kind of interesting. And all this is really on one side of the fence, that David is in a foreign atmosphere, in a foreign place, and seems to be thriving. And again, David is a man of faith. This is all based on his emunah and his sense of purpose and whatever. We know about David already. And as a contrast, We've got now the story of Shaul, which is happening sort of in a parallel universe where clearly things are falling apart. As much as David should be falling apart and isn't, Shaul, on the other hand, should not be falling apart and is. And this is really the kind of balance, I think, that you've got in this particular chapter. Pasuk Gimel, Shmuel died. They basically, we read about this already a few weeks ago, that they buried him in Ramah, in his city. And Shaul, one of the things that presumably he had done on the basis of instruction from Shmuel was to rid the land of these people, necromancers, diviners. One of his big campaigns, Shaul, was to get rid of these people because they obviously were a danger to the religious standards of Eretz Israel. They brought possible idolatrous practices and who knows what, superstition into the land. Okay, whatever it was about. And don't ask me, there's to do with bones and to do with seances and whatever. Okay, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. So what happened here? Pasuk Dalet. So now the Philistines are camped in Shunem. And Shaul with all his men are in Gilboa. So there's obviously now a standoff between the two sides. So Shaul saw the camp. Reminds us of the story going back to Goliath, the same story. And he was absolutely trembling and fearful. He was shaking. Literally his knees were shaking. He didn't know what to do. And he's desperate. So he asks of God, V'lo ano Hashem. It was no answer. Gam b'chalomot, but either through dreams. In other words, and again, some of the Mefarshim want to suggest that what they used to do is leave a piece of paper. Sounds like the tooth fairy. Leave a piece of paper under your pillow, and you'd wake up in the morning, and there'd be a message on the paper. Okay, don't ask me how that worked. I really don't know. And this would be a message from God, which you had to decipher, you had to work it out. That's one of the suggestions, what chalomot means. Obviously, the more obvious suggestion is that, you know, you would get some sort of message in a dream, in a trance or whatever. Gam ba'urim v'gam ba'navim, but he didn't have an answer from the Urim v'tumim, which was the way to connect to God through the Kohen, and v'gam ba'navim, and none of the prophets could connect him to Hashem. Basically, he was completely disconnected. Look at Pasuk Zion. So he says to his servants, Bakshu li eshet balat om. Now here comes the absolute, the irony of ironies. He has spent his whole kingship, one of his campaigns, was to get rid of all these people. And now, Balat Ov, he's looking for someone who practices necromancy. He's looking for a woman who does this. The Elcha Ilev Edresha Ba, and he says that I need to go to her and I will ask of her because I need an answer. I've got to speak to my Rebbe. I've got to find out what to do. Shmuel is dead. So the only way I can contact Shmuel, I'm not getting any answer from God. That's already, that, as they say in Hebrew, tafuz. That's engaged, that's busy. It's not answering, so he's got to go another route. And the other route is through a really unbelievable route. He wants to go through this woman who is the necromancer. Vayoma v'adav elav, so his servants say, hine eshet balato be'endor. So there is a woman who does this, and she lives in a place called Endor. So what do I know about Ein Dor? About 20 years ago, whatever, we went on a tiyul with a family, my wife's uncle, and they used to drive what is called a tender in Israel. Tender is a very, to me, it was always a funny name. It's basically I don't know how you describe it. It's basically like a minibus without seats. You're sitting in the back of this kind of bus, and they call it tender. And the only thing that happens after you get out is that you really are feeling very tender for obvious reasons. That to me was always the reason why I thought they called it a tender. We went in this tender. We went on this trip, and we went to Ein Dor, and I blew my mind. I said, "This is really Ein Dor." And it turns out there's a kibbutz there, and what they make in Ein Dor, and I don't know if they still do it. They make fantastic toys. All right, I suppose maybe in the tradition of the Balat Ov doing some sort of hocus pocus that she used to do, nowadays Ein Dor, it's not a religious kibbutz, but it was an interesting place to visit. They have a toy factory. They had it there. I don't know if they still have it there. It's in the north of Israel. So this is what's going on. He's found a witch, Balat Ov, or whatever she is, excuse me, and she's in Ein Dor. Now, Shaul doesn't want to scare the living daylights out of her, because if he goes dressed as the king, she's going to plus, because she is, as she knows from Shaul's campaign, he is out to kill all the witches. He's going to kill all the diviners. So he has to dress up. Vayitchapesh Shaul. Vayilbash begadim achirim. Basically, he dressed up, he put on other clothes. Vayelechu, and he goes, ushnei anashim imo, and he has his two men with him. Vayavol isha, Laila comes at night time, so she doesn't recognize him. It's all in the dark. Vayoma, and he says, Kasamin ali ba'ov ali li et asher ma'alech elai. Basically, he asks her to do whatever she does, and bring this person to me, from the grave, from the other side, or wherever it is. Vatoma isha elav. So the woman says, Hinei ata yadat et asher asah Shaul. So she gives him a lesson about the king. Talking to the king. She says, don't you know what Shaul has done? He's got rid of all these necromancers, people who do this stuff. Right? They've all been wiped out. So if you're forcing me to do this, you'll lead to my death. Because Shaul will hear about it, and he'll come chasing after me. How can you put me in this compromising position? Now here's the terrible irony. He has to make an oath. A promise to her, Bashem, in the name of God. And this is, you know, how almost sacrilegious this sounds, but this is desperation. Shaul is so desperate, he needs his Rebbe to tell him what to do. So he makes this oath, and he says, Chai Hashem, by the life of God, im yikreich avon b'davar hazeh, nothing will happen to you for doing what you're about to do. He's promised her amnesty in terms of this situation. Now, all right, that's the way it is. And as I said, terrible irony in what's going on here. So the woman said, okay, if that's the case, let's go ahead and do what we do. You know, when I read this, I have to tell the students, because they don't know this movie. But everybody knows it. The film Ghost. All right, you really think back to that movie, Whoopi Goldberg. This is the image that comes to my mind every time I think about this. Particularly that scene where she actually gets a response, which she doesn't expect. You know, who was the guy? I forgot now, the actor. It's Patrick Swayze, wasn't it? Yeah. And she gets this answer, you know, which she's just so... She's more scared than anything else. And this is the image that sticks in my mind when I read this. So look what happens here. Pasuk Yudal. Vatoma Ishad Mi'alela. So she says, who shall I bring up for you? You know, she's probably giving him a menu. Who do you want to see? Vayoma, and of course he says the name that she was dreading. Ed Shmuel Halili, bring back Shmuel. What is going on here, as I said, we'll see in a few minutes. But excuse me. Vateresh Ed Shmuel, so she saw Shmuel, Vatizak Bakol Gadol, and she screamed an enormous scream. Why did she scream? Rashi explains. Sorry? Shmuel was dead, but she brought him up as a kind of image. And you know what happened? Why did she scream? Because all of her images used to come up upside down. Okay, this is what Chazal tell us. Shmuel came up the right side, the right way up. And therefore that to her was a shock. Because she, you know, once she realized who this is, then she put two and two together and realized that the guy standing next to her who wants to see the image is none other than Shaul HaMelech. In other words, she's in real trouble. So she screamed. Vatame Shaul Shaul, so she says to Shaul Lemor, Lama Rimitani, Ata Shaul, I now know who you are. Why did you cheat me? You're Shaul. Vayom Elohamela, Al Tiri, don't be afraid, he said to her, Kima Ra'it. What did you see? Vatame Shaul Shaul, and of course it seems to imply that he doesn't see it. She is seeing it, and he isn't seeing it, which again is an interesting problem which we'll deal with in a minute. Sorry? Because it's Shmuel, and obviously, who would want to see Shmuel? You know, this is not a person. You don't bring back somebody like that unless, you know, this is Choshev Yid, and very Choshev Yid, and you've got to be a Choshev Yid to want to see that Choshev Yid. You know, this is like going to the Rebbe of Rebbes. This is scary, and she blows her mind over this. And of course, she realizes now who wants to speak to him, none other than Shaul. I guess that she had this suspicion all the way along. But she went along with it because it could be that she even felt that maybe this is not going to happen. You know, who knows? As I said, you know, there's a whole discussion over here as to whether this is for real. But in the meantime, of course, the message comes back, whichever way it comes to him, and it's very sad, as you'll see in a minute. So, Yud Gimel. Vayom Elohi Melech Altiri Kima Ra'it, Vatamei Shal Shaul Elohim Ra'iti Olim Min Ha'aretz. I saw, literally, it seems that the translation here is angels. Angels coming up from the ground, because the fact is that Shmuel was accompanied, according to Chazal, by Moshe And who else does it say here? I've forgotten now. There were two of them. Was it Moshe and Pinchas or Moshe and somebody else? I don't remember. Angels here. Two angels, Moshe and Shmuel. Ah, okay, Moshe and Shmuel. Basically, what happened was that Moshe came along, I suppose, for the ride. Okay, so you know, there you are. You've got to imagine this picture. It's very dark. All of a sudden, she's done whatever she did in order to bring these images into the room or wherever they are. And, wow, it's Shmuel on one side, and it's Moshe Rabbeinu on the other side. That is enough to scare the dimly daylights out of anybody. One of them, both of them, whoa, this is really too much. And, you know, she's frightened out of her wits. Vayomela. So the king says to her, Mataro. Again, he doesn't seem to be able to see what she's seeing. What does he look like? Vatoma, so she says, Ish Zakenole. He's a Zaken. We know that he was described as Zaken. He died when he was 52 years old. So that's not really Zaken, certainly not by today's standards, but I suppose, you know, that with all the tzaras and everything that he had to deal with, you know, you get old very quickly. For who, Otem Me'il, he's wearing a cloak, and remember that was something that for Sha'ul was very significant, because he'd torn the corner of the cloak. And Vayeda Sha'ul Ki Shmuel, he knew it was Shmuel, Vayikoda Paimasa Vishtocha, and he was incredibly excited, he was incredibly happy, because he could have, excuse me, a conversation with his Rebbe. And at this point in time, you know, he really feels as if he's going to get an answer to his question, what to do now, go to war, not to go to war, what's going to be. So look what happened. Shmuel is, whatever this is of Shmuel, he's livid. Tedva, Vayomer Shmuel el Shaul, lama higazdani, la'alot oti, why have you made me, you've angered me to bring me up. In other words, this is not the right thing to do. Shaul said, I'm in such trouble. Plishtin ilchamim bi. And you know, you can sense the desperation of this man. And all of a sudden, of course, he's now been clued in to the conversation. Till now, he didn't see it, and all of a sudden, he can see it. And he's saying, the Plishtim are fighting me. Velohim same olai, God has gone away from me. Velo anani oda, I'm not getting any response from Hashem. Gam biyad anavim, gam b'chalomod, whether it's through the prophets, through the dreams. Vekra lacha lo dieni ma'asa. I want to know what to do. Please, Rebbe, tell me what to do. Vayomer Shmuel. And this is the saddest answer in the whole story. Vayomer Shmuel v'lama tishaleni. Why are you asking me? Vashem sami alecha v'yarecha. Surely this is the obvious answer you've got, because God has withdrawn from you. Hashem is not with you anymore. Vayihi arecha is with your enemy. In other words, the sense that Hashem has left you, surely that's the answer. The answer is that, you know, this is not going to be a battle that you're going to win. It's going to be a battle which is going to be a defeat. And it's so sad. Yud Zayin, Vayas Hashem lo kasher dibe biyadi. God did to him as he said to me. Vayikra Hashem et mamlecha miyadecha. God has torn the kingdom from you. Vayina lereacha leDavid. All of a sudden it's spelled out clearly, and we've already spoken about this. Now it's being told absolutely that the new king will be David, and the kingdom is torn away from you. This idea of kara, because of tearing, the tearing of the cloak, the symbolism of what it refers to. And further, Yudchet, kasher lo shamata b'kol Hashem v'lo asita charon apo b'amalek. And he's giving the whole reason now. You didn't do what you had to do against Amalek. Al kein adavar hazeh asalecha Hashem ayom hazeh. That's why God is doing this to you today. Vayitein Hashem gam et Yisrael imcha b'yad plishtim, and Israel will be handed over also to the plishtim. Umachar, here comes the worst news, atav anecha imi, you and your sons will be with me. Now what does that obviously mean? That they're going to die. It's a very great euphemism here, but that's exactly what it means. Gam et machane Yisrael, yitein Hashem b'yad plishtim, and the camp of Israel will be given over to the plishtim. Of course, at this point, Shaul is completely devastated, as we all would be. And he fell down, and Malekumato is a stress. We know that he's very tall, so he must have completely collapsed to the ground. He was so afraid of what Shmuel said. He hadn't eaten the whole night, the whole day, and he had no koach left. He was completely and utterly exhausted. Unbelievable. And here comes something very interesting. This must have been a Yiddish mama, because as much as she was involved in all of this hocus pocus, she also had a bowl of chicken soup for him. So funny. She comes to Shaul. She saw that he was in a bad state. He was in shock. Listen to what you said. I'm going to take my life in my hands. In other words, I'm going to help you. And now I want you, I listened to what you said to me, so now listen to what I have to say to you. Listen to what I have to say to you. Here's a bit of bread. And eat. And then you'll have strength. That you can go away. Here's the bowl of chicken soup. And basically she's trying to revive it. You know, Nebuchadnezzar has such rachmanis for him. By your mind. But he doesn't want to hear of it. He refuses because he feels now that this is such a punch. This is such a blow on him. Such a something against him. He can't eat. And they start pleading with him. Please, Shaul, eat something. Gamesha, also the woman, and he gave in and he listened and he begins to get up again. So it's almost like, you know, somebody who is reviving, and we can see the sort of the medical thing that's going on here, but also there is a sense of coming to terms with his situation. Shaul realizes that the end is almost upon him. And to be perfectly honest, as sad and as depressing and as awful as this sounds, there is going to be a sense of gevura, of courage, comes out of Shaul, which is remarkable. And that's going to be ready beginning now. You can see he's picking himself up symbolically as well as physically. So she had this kind of, you know, whatever it was in the freezer, she had this in the house, she had this meat. Yeah. So she had this calf and she shechted it. She's a very useful lady. And she baked matzahs. Was it Pesach? I don't even know. We're not even told here, but whatever, they probably would have had matzah maybe other times. So they had something to eat. And then they went away on that night. This is the most unreal story. It's unreal. And you know, you see this and you say to yourself, the obvious question is, what's going on here? Is this really happening? So I want to share this with you because this is just something spectacular. If you just want to give these out, just want to pass them around. This Sefer Nishmas Chaim, which I mentioned before, he's dealing with a lot of interesting things. He's dealing with the issue, as far as he's concerned, of the neshama. He's dealing with the issues of reincarnation, which we actually do believe in. There's some pretty hairy stories or hairy traditions about who is a reincarnation of whom. I just have to tell you my reincarnation story because this is for real. When I was learning in yeshiva in Gateshead, one of the things you do, all yeshivas around the world, you learn Mishmar on Thursday nights. So we were learning, my chavrusa, we were learning whatever we were doing. It was like 12 o'clock Thursday night. We finished by 1 o'clock. And for about a month, next to where we were learning, there's a windowsill, and there was a cat sitting on the windowsill for an hour. And the cat literally every week for an hour, not making this up, this is for real. And the cat sat there, and then after an hour, the cat disappeared. And this happened for about a month. And then afterwards, the cat didn't come back anymore. So, you know, we were a bit curious. So we mentioned it to the Rosh Yeshiva. We went to see him and we said, you know, we've got a question, which might sound ridiculous, but just, you know, it's been bothering us. And he listened to what we told him, what happened. And to him, it was obvious. And he said, obviously, this is a reincarnation, a Gilgal. So we looked, you know, my eyes popped out. I mean, could you explain that, please? So he said, yeah, it's probably a reincarnation of someone who maybe in his former life had an opportunity to learn and failed the opportunity and was coming back for a couple of hours of Torah, even if he was listening to it as, or she or whatever, as a cat. That really scared me. And was sitting there for an hour, literally, sha'ad meduyeket, you know, an absolute hour, and then disappearing. And that was his explanation of the event. I couldn't sleep that night. After he told me this explanation, you know, and we started looking for this cat, and we never found it ever again. It's just an unbelievable thing. And there is this tradition, and it was going through, maybe from Eastern Europe, I don't know, the idea of Gilgulim and reincarnation and all this sort of thing, which was really, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, next week Lag BaOmer, and you know, if you sort of get involved in all the interesting stuff of Lag BaOmer, interesting literature of Lag BaOmer. You'll come across all of these tremendous traditions about Gilgal, which is part of what it's all about. Who is the reincarnation of whom and who appears where? And all the rabbis, certainly in that particular time period, around the 15th century, which is, you know, when all the sort of Kabbalists emerged in Israel, this is one of the things that they're into. So, sorry? Why was it a cat? Oh, the cat had to be a cat because it was cats, yeah. I heard something something pretty scary. Yeah, that was very good. It's almost like the name, there's a very famous Rav called Azulai, right? Rav Azulai was the Chidot. Why was he called Azulai? He was a Kohen, right? But wait a second, what was why? Because, what does it say in the laning? Isha Zona V'chalolo Lo Yikachu, that the name was based on the pasuk, the first letter of every word of that pasuk, and they got the name Azulai. It's unbelievable. So, yeah. So it's this week's parsha. So you never know, Mr. Katz or otherwise. All right, have a look at this. I'm not going to go through everything here, but as you can see, you've got A, B, C, D, and E, and there's all different interpretations of what is going on with this story. Listen to that. The language is worth just staying with, certainly for A. Look what he says at the top here. And this is taken from Sefer Nishmas Chaim, Menashe ben Israel, who, as I wrote here, around the 1600. I'm not sure exactly of his dates, but that's when he functioned in Amsterdam, in Holland. And he writes as follows. Hine, hu parat parei revet. Basically, in the continuation of what he was talking about before, we can now understand what's going on with Shaul, with the witch of Endor. What was happening? When he brought back Shmuel Hanavi. And he says, it's very difficult. It's the strangest story, one of the strangest stories in the whole Bible. Because it doesn't fit with our mind, our knowledge, that these pure souls, that this necromancer, whatever that means, can have any control over such a person. How could she have controlled Shmuel to bring him back from the grave? What was going on? How could she bring such a holy man back? A man of God. That, as Shmuel says, why did you bring me back? So the suggestion is that she managed to do this. So what is the explanation? And here we go through a walk in history. We start with the Gaonim, that period, and we work our way through till we get to Menashe ben Israel in the 1600s, who gives a very, very interesting interpretation. His interpretation, I have to say, of all of them, I think I like the most. But let's see what the other rabbis say. The first item, and it's about six lines down, underlined. V'livrach min ha-safek, rabim bikshu drachim. In order to answer this question, many people look for different paths. V'heima lo ni'imi, but I'm not comfortable with any of them. They're not very pleasant. All right? Derechecha darchi no'am, but in this case, it's not darchi no'am. Why? Ki harav Shmuel ben Chofni, the first rabbi he quotes, they all quote him, is Shmuel ben Chofni, one of the rabbis of the Middle Ages. Asaf ruach b'chofnam. I love the way they use the language. He gathered some wind in his sails, or in his bellows. I think the idea is that he was, bellows meaning he was exuding a lot of hot air at the time. That's what he basically wants to say. Play on Chofni. Ibn Ezra does this all the time. Ibn Ezra quotes a Rabbi Yitzchak. And Rabbi Yitzchak that he quotes is a Rabbi Yitzchak who is a Karaite. So he says, Rabbi Yitzchak, kach shemo, kashmo kenu, tzchok, he's a joke. All right, this is what Ibn Ezra says. I mean, you know, this is cutting people down to size. And well, that's already we saw Novel, but that the rabbis were so harif against each other. And look what he says here. He took in some wind in his sails, and he said the following thing: V'chashav machshavot aven, and his whole process of thought process is completely wrong. But Omra, because you know what he says: Ki lo diber Shmuel im Shaul. There was no conversation with Shmuel and Shaul. When we just read about it, but what was going on? He says, "V'chas v'shalom." Lo alami kivro mina isha asta hakol berama. Oh, that's why I said I think of Whoopi Goldberg. The woman brought him up in a way of trickery. Ki miyad hikira, because she recognized ki Shaulhu, that it was Shaul. Ach laharot lo. Excuse me, but to show him ki mitzada chokma hikira, that she wanted to show him that she was recognizing this from her wisdom. Umatzada vazeh. Amra lama rimitani vata Shaul. She basically says to him, why did you trick me in your Shaul? And just bear with me a second. V'derech balat ov lahavi ben adam. What she normally would do is bring somebody in the side room, shemadaber mitoch machpo'o, who talks from his hidden place, b'lashon namuch, in a very low voice, right? Unbelievable. Okay, you know, you see these sometimes. Agatha Christie was very good at this. If you ever saw those particular movies, she always had a seance, and then something was going on, there was a voice, and of course, Mrs. Marple was always on top of that. V'chol ma shehi, unbelievable. V'chol ma shehi gida lo b'shem Shmuel haya mider sfar. So basically what he's saying is, this woman made the whole thing up. And the only thing that supports Rabbi Shmuel ben Chofni is the fact that she, we pointed out that really she's having the conversation initially with Shmuel, and Shaul isn't. So it could very well be, he wants to suggest that she is making the whole thing up. Ki kulam yodim shedavid nimshach lamelech, because everybody knew David was already the king, at least the king elect. V'chihu yetzei lamilchama, he's going to lead the war. V'chashva shegia ata. Excuse me. Ito likach Hashem imenu nekama nigmastam avadav hanaviim hashavur. Basically, maybe it was a time of revenge against Shaul. Shaul had been chasing David for such a long time. This was Shaul's, time to be punished. Ulezer Omar machar tabanechimi. That's why she could say, "You are going to die tomorrow," because that she felt was what was going to happen. But he says, "Va'davar hazeh yotek kasher beinai." This is so difficult to suggest that she made the whole thing up. Ki akatuv machish kozeh. We just read the pasuk, which says that Shaul and Shmuel had a conversation. Ve'ech ne'emar she'Shaul b'chir Hashem holech hashichim ka'achad harikim. How can we suggest that Shaul was just going like one of these empty vessels, mishtamesh b'divrei hitulim, tachbulot anashim, and he was using something which really was not more than a joke or something which was being used. He basically says this whole approach to say that this was a whole trick doesn't work. All right, so let's go to the other extreme, number two. We'll see what the Radak says. And the Radak goes to another extreme, and he says, you know what? V'aradak evi gamhu deya datagon rabsadya rabhaigon. He brings two other gaonim, rabsadya gaon rabhaigon, and he says the following. V'zeh l'shono, ava rabsadya rabhaigonim amru. They say, emetu, it's true. Ki rachok, it's very far-fetched, sh'teidai sh'atidon. This woman would know the future. In other words, they disagree with Rav Shmuel ben Chofni. V'chein sh'tiyeh ito ha'met b'chokhmat ha'ov. In other words, she would be able to bring him back in such a way. It's impossible. Ach ha'borei hechia et Shmuel. This is the other extreme. It's all from God. Hashem did the whole thing. God brought back Shmuel. To tell him everything was going to happen. But of course, this also doesn't work. Because if Hashem is going to bring back Shmuel in such a way, then do it in the conventional way, for goodness sake. Bring him back in as a chalom. Bring him back as a nevuah. Bring him back in some sort of conventional way. Why should he be brought back in such a for want of a better word, a derech tumah? This is unbelievable, and this is the argument essentially which Rav Menashe ben Israel argues against the Radak, and he says this doesn't make sense. How can you honestly suggest that he would be brought back in such a way when, in fact, there were so many other ways that a Kodesh Baruch Hu could have done this? Really, by Urim V'Tumim, or he could have done it in the way of a Chalom. Why would he do it in such a negative way? And therefore, he dismisses. Argument number two. So again, first argument, it was a trick. It was a spiel, and that again doesn't fit into the whole story. The second argument is to say, well, it's all really from Hashem, which is a very sort of much more noble way of explaining it, but also doesn't fit in. Yeah.
It makes sense that making Shaul go through the most negative approach to show that doing a conventional appearance you cannot have, you don't deserve it anymore.
He doesn't deserve it. That was, I was thinking, that would be an answer for the Radak. Yeah, we can stay with that. But interestingly, the Nishmas Chaim doesn't like that. All right, and I was thinking that is an answer for the Radak. Look what he goes on, and it's a few lines down the Ralbag. If you're with me, it's about sort of just over halfway down, underline. The Ralbag Katav is C, where it's next to the C. He says, Ralbag says, Ki al derech emet, lo hola mimenu, v'lo yigia mimenu, shum dibur l'sha'u. Nothing really came to Shaul in terms of a message. Aval haya ze kulo po'el mipulot ha-dimayon. So the Ralbag says, you know what happened? It's all in Shmuel's imagination. It actually was not a real event. He was dreaming this event. He dreamed that what happened was, again, the whole story is meant to be understood as a dream. That he fell asleep, and he dreamt that he went to see this woman, and this is what happened. And of course, when he woke up, he had the whole message, which was that he was going to die in battle, and that was going to be the story. And what happens to the two companions? I mean, he says it just doesn't work as a dream. It just doesn't make sense. Look, just you see where there's a gap over here in the paragraph. Again, I don't want to go through the whole thing, but he brings here Shekavah Hiksha Alav Hari. Basically, he says the Ababana asks a question on the Ralbag. He says most people can distinguish between something which is muchash, something which you can sense, and something which you imagine. So to suggest that this is all part of Shaul's imagination, but he thinks it's for real, it doesn't work. It's suggesting, again, we're back to the whole question of was Shaul in a state of illness and state of mental disability, and we've already proven that that's not the case. Certainly, you know, he's got his faculties with him, but he's a desperate man, that's for sure. So basically, again, what the Ralbag tries to do here doesn't fit into the whole story to suggest that it is part of Shaul's imagination. Now here comes something which, again, I've just got to say one or two words. Section D is a suggestion which you'll find this in many, many writings of that period, going back to the Abarbanel, even earlier. They are prepared to quote the non-Jewish source. Now, it comes a bit of a shock because, you know, we look upon sort of Bible analysis as being, you know, in the realm of Gedolei Yisrael, and it certainly is. But they weren't in any way closed to suggestions and to ideas which would come from essentially from the church, where who else was studying the Bible? And the interaction, particularly in a place like Amsterdam, was so interesting, and other places, and Abarbanel does this very often, he quotes Chochmei Notzrim, without even saying who they are, and this is something which you find in this literature, which is very, very interesting. It's basically saying there is malumo, there is something to learn, but it may not necessarily answer the question, but I have to give it space. And this is very fascinating. If you want to read more about this, you have to open up Hertz Chumash, which has gone out of favor. Most people don't have this anymore. Going over to the art scroll, which I don't even want to talk about, because Hertz Chumash was such a phenomenal commentary. Hertz was an interesting man. Became chief rabbi in England, but he originates out of JTS from the early 1900s when, you know, there were some pretty substantial scholars floating around in JTS in those days. And his whole Chumash is so traditional, but at the same time has got this element, that if he finds a commentary, a nuance from somewhere, which is not necessarily from a traditional source, but gives us an insight into what's going on, he's prepared to quote it. And I mentioned it when I spoke about Nechama Levis, she did the same thing. She quotes very often from somebody called Benno Jacob. Benno Jacob was a very famous Reform rabbi in Germany. And she quotes extensively, all the way through her writings, the comments of Benno Jacob. And she justified it because she said there's a principle in Talmud that you take the truth wherever you can find it, right? That the MS is out there, and if you find it in a place which is not necessarily a place which we normally find it, but, you know, don't ignore it. It may be very well something that will give you an insight which you never had before. And this is something very interesting. So with all of that, I just want to quote section D and then get to the bottom line. and this is from the bottom on the right hand side, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines, 8 lines up. Okay, Va'achash Sata Chacham Haniskar Das Agustino Chacham Mechachmei Agoyim. What happens now is that there's a fourth opinion, and it's somebody called Agostino. All right, now I'm not sure this is D'Agostino, the origin of the supermarket, who knows. But this is a gentleman who is quoted, and Shechasham Shlo Alashmuel Klal, He says it wasn't Shmuel, aval shed, shin dalet, shed bidemut Shmuel. It was a demon in the form of Shmuel. And of course, this fits in, I suppose, you know, if you want to sort of read about this, look in the Encyclopedia Judaica about demonology and the whole sort of mindset of what's going on. And essentially, Menashe ben Israel gives it a lot of space. He's basically prepared to consider that this was some sort of demon which was being presented by this woman in the form of Shmuel, which wasn't really Shmuel, but came out with the message that Shaul was, not that he wanted to hear the message, but the message that was kind of obvious for Shaul to hear. So, you know, if you like that particular approach, all well and good, but again, it just doesn't jive. So basically, what we're going to do is, after we've seen all that, I'm just going to jump you to the next column right in the middle, where it's underlined. And basically, what's happening here, because he talks a lot about this whole thing of the demons, and I don't want to go into that. That's something you can look at yourselves. But what I want to show you is as following. And this is something very interesting. It's underlined, the second underlining. Umi ha'ish ha'chacham v'yaven et zot, asher lo yomar alav ki hevel hevi gamhu. Basically, what he's saying is that the whole discussion of what was going on here in terms of the opinion of the non-Jew, he says in the end of the day is also Hevel. He doesn't accept it. If you just go down a little bit further, where it's underlined, not the next one, the next underline, the second underlining after that, Hey Mamru, he now goes to his fifth explanation. Again, we saw the first one that it was a trick, it was some sort of Rama'ut. The second explanation that it was all from Hashem, but that doesn't fit in necessarily to the story. Third explanation, it was in his mind, it was imagination of Shaul. Fourth explanation, it's a demon, demonology going on here. The fifth explanation of Rabbi Nasha ben Yisrael is unbelievable. He says that you've got to go back to the beginning of the Perek. He says when you look at the beginning of the Perek, there is some very strange stuff. Before you get to this story, it mentions in Pasuk Gimel, Ushmol met, Shmol died. We know he died, right? We already told this in chapter 25, Perek Kafche. So why then does he introduce the story of the witch of Endor with this news, which is not old news? We know that Shmuel had died. Says Rabbi Nasha ben Israel something quite unbelievable. He says that we know there is a tradition that we say Kaddish essentially for 12 months after a person dies. And he says we actually do 11 months. So the question is why? So various explanations, and the most common explanation is that it takes the longest time it takes for the neshama to go back to the Kisei HaKavod, whatever that means, is 12 months. So we, in fact, we consider ourselves in Avelis for that 12 months to say the Kaddish, but as a sign of hope, I suppose, we stop the Kaddish a month early to show that not, you know, even the worst Jew is not absolutely as bad as that, and the neshama has already been taken back to the Kisei HaKavod. Is it going to come back again as a cat or whatever? I don't even want to think about that. But whatever it may be, that's the story that we, that's the explanation that we give. The question is, what happens during those 11, or let's call it 12 months? What is happening to the neshama before it goes back to its resting place? And on that, Rabbi Nasha ben Israel, of course, this is his whole sefer. He says that that's something that we have to understand. The neshama has a place in this world. It's there, it's listening. That's what the Kaddish is really, part of it is about. The Kaddish has got two functions. Kaddish is Yiskadal Viskadash, or Yiskadel, if you're into that, Yiskadesh, which is the idea of filling the vacuum. When a person dies, there is a tremendous vacuum which we hope the name of God will fill. So that's the Yiskadel, should become greater, the name of God, to fill the vacuum with the loss of that person, which is one element of Kaddish, which is a different discussion. And also, the idea of Kaddish is that it, as we say, the neshama shall have an aliyah, this expression that we use, what does it mean? It means that the process for those 11 or 12 months is that the neshama is oleh, it's going up and up, ideally back to its source. And the Kaddish, we believe, in whatever way it happens, helps that neshama to rise. What's going on over here is that this Baladov is calling on Shmuel and he comes back. You know why? Because it's in the 12 months. He hasn't been dead for a year yet. So his neshama is still floating around somewhere. Don't ask me how she knew where to contact him. You know, sort of this is, you can't even do this on Google. You know, how do you get hold of a neshama? But the reality is, this is what she seems to have known. Unbelievable.
As a rational person, wouldn't it seem to make more sense that he was delirious, he was in a state of panic,
yeah,
really imagine the whole
Yeah, the answer is that it's so real, and the way it's presented is like a conversation. It can't be. And that's the imagination that we had in section C. That was the Rabbah, which was a very logical explanation. You're absolutely right. The Rabbah is a rationalist. He's like Rambam. He's very much like Rambam the whole time. But he said, and we didn't go through all the arguments, but it just doesn't work. It doesn't fit into the context of the whole story. Right? Although we can argue and we can debate this, and this is a whole debate by itself, right? That every answer that we've given is a discussion. But I just want to go through this last answer because this is something just that is worth knowing. Alright, and this is where it's underlined over here, and he quotes from the Gemara. Haim Amru Masechet Shaban. I'm just going to finish very quickly. He says in Gemara Shabbos, Perek Klal Gadol. It's chapter 7 of Gemara Shabbos. Omaleahu Barnash the Rabavot. There's a certain gentleman said to Rabbi Vo, Amri to tell me, Nishmatan shel tzadikim gnuzot tachat kisei hakavod, ucha tchamya hecha sikte lishmu b'negida. Basically, the question was asked that if the souls of the righteous are under the heavenly throne, how could Shmuel's neshama be accessed, right? Amale, so Rab, who is this? Rab Avos said, Hasan besoch yud beis chodesh hava. It was within the 12 months. V'tanya, because we've learned kol shnei masa chodesh gufu kayam. The body remains, as it were, intact, as whatever that means, because we know the reality it's not, but there's some sort of sense that there's something after a person dies within the guf. V'nishmato ole v'yoredet, the soul goes up and down. La'acha yud beis chodesh, after 12 months, ha'guf batel, the body is already gone, it's decomposed. V'aneshama ole, the shama goes up. V'shuv eni yoredet, and doesn't come down. And says Rabbi Nasha ben Izra Reina, we're not talking about something tome going up to God, something impure. It's not like that. Very difficult to read this. Basically, she had the ability to access the neshama in this state of limbo that it's in, and she could bring it back. This is unbelievable. V'adas hu hazeh hu atzmo das ha-mekubolim. V'chein b'seif hazeh. He said, this is a very Kabbalistic approach. Al pasuk, where it says, V'ariti et dim'at ha-shukim katuv le'mor, k'shenim shachim ha-neshamot ha-kedoshot l'redet l'mata, when the souls come down, yesh makom tiklot b'tiklin, there's a certain place where they become afflicted. Don't ask me what this is talking about. I really don't know. When the soul leaves the body, it's still alive. Nishmat Chayim, that's the name of the Sefer. The Neshama is still alive. Wow. V'sholim otam, you ask them, umase ha'ov eino hevel v'toh. He says it wasn't nonsense. They really could relate, they could connect to the Neshama in that no man's land in that period of the first 12 months. Kasher choshu rabim, as many people thought it was hevel, it was nonsense, it really is not true. Ukevaru chazal devarim harbe binyan ha'ov, and he doesn't want to go into it anymore. He's said enough. He's spooked you out enough. That's basically what's happened here. It's an unbelievable explanation.
Isn't really the thought that the greater the tzaddik, the less time it takes?
It should be the less time. So again, how long has Shmuel been dead? And again, it could very well be that he's only been dead for a few weeks. I mean, it might have not even been weeks. It might have been a few days. Right? And that's why the pasuk at the beginning repeats the death of Shmuel. And as a consequence, you know, straight away after that, you've got the whole story with the Baalat Ein Dor and the connection. And Rav Nachman ben Israel says, of all the explanations, that's the one that I feel really, as much as I don't understand a word of what he said, it makes the most sense. It's one of those things that we have to sort of put into the world of Kabbalah. It's a Kabbalistic explanation. This is not Shmuel imagining things. I'm still inclined to go for that. I'll be honest, I don't disagree with you or what we said before, the other options, but whichever way you understand this, as I said at the beginning, this whole story comes with a health warning. It's not something that we should indulge in. It's not something that we do. And this is what, again, a lot of people got very upset. I just want to mention this as a sort of modern day application. I know the Bavitcher Rebbe, and a lot of people mention about this, with incredibly intense and very great person. But I'm pretty sure that he would not have approved of what was going on. I'm not sure whether they still do this, but people who go to the grave to daven there, you daven at holy places, but to sleep there overnight, which is some of the stuff that was going on, I hope it's stopped by now, but I just don't know, that's already not the way to go. Certainly not when we're reading all of this stuff. You know, we've got to have, I suppose, a certain concept that there is a, we talk about Kvod HaMet, and the Kvod HaMet is usually, the euphemism is Kvod HaChayim. And in fact, the reality is that according to what we're saying here, it's not a euphemism. Kvod HaMet, there is a chius there, there's a different sort of energy there, but it's an energy that we just don't understand. But obviously, in this story, it's something which is teaching us, it's there, it's not to be accessed, the Torah was very much against this whole thing, the Torah forbids it, and Shaul only did it as a in a total situation of desperation. This was not his first choice, he had nothing else that he could do. It worked out incredibly bad for him, the whole conclusion of this. But at the same time, it really is, as they say, something to go away and think about. It's an unbelievable story. I'll leave you to ponder on this, because it's just an incredible thing. This is the story of the Witch of Endor, with a bit of explanation, trying to make it a bit more understandable. Bezrat Hashem, as I said at the beginning, next week we'll talk very briefly about chapters 29 and 30. And we'll try to deal a bit with probably the saddest conclusion of any character, the suicide, or what looks like the suicide of Shaul in the Perek Chof Aleph. At the end, we'll try and make a bit of an upbeat. We'll talk, maybe give a short hesped on Shaul HaMelech. He deserves more than that, because this is a very special man. To be continued. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.